My name's Josh Alvarez.
And I'm Liam O'Donnell.
And you're listening to episode 126 of Cinepunks.
Cinepunks.
That's us. That's who we be. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Welcome to, I'm assuming, the millions of new listeners we gained by interviewing LDP. I'm assuming that now with that, I mean, we don't know. Like, we're
was
off
there
a little
LDP
bit because we're
bump? Did we get an LDP bump?
I just assume we must be the most popular podcast in the world now after that LDP bump. No, I don't know that that's true. I do know that.
I assume that we were the most popular podcast in the world before the LDP bump. So,
no,
you
see,
know,
that's
because
you don't
listen to podcasts.
I was going to say, you don't.
Yeah.
You don't know the cultural phenomena that unfortunately is Joe Rogan. So that's.
Right.
That's where podcasts actually are.
No, the greatest is I used to have friends. I had friends that wrote books, right? And they were not the best books. But, you know, these friends of mine, they were the kind of friends that would be like, hey, Josh, would you edit my book if I buy you lunch today? And, you know, I'm a helper. So a lot of the times I would be like, yeah, sure, just give me the fucking book. And I'd read these things and they're terrible.
Yeah.
But in both cases of this occurrence in my life,
yeah,
which both happened when I was formerly employed at the place where I used to work, the books were all like, they're both like pretty bad, but both authors were like, well, I don't read books, so I don't want to taint my vision. And you know what?
No.
Yeah, not reading books to write a book. I mean, to be clear with everybody, I edited these books with a crayon, just so you know, what was happening. That's like not even hyperbole or a joke. Like, that's real. Like, I just fucking wrote on that. I got a crayon from the fucking resource room at the psych unit and then did it with that because what am I going to do? You know what I'm saying? Like, and the funny thing about it is, though, there's a little bit of wisdom to, I don't read books. I just write them. It's like,
no,
Garth Marenghi was like, I'm one of the rare authors
to
who's
that. There's literally
read more or written more books than I've read. That's the Garth Marenghi right there.
No.
Yeah.
All of that's
no,
terrible.
It's incorrect. No. Yeah. But as far as like my delusion in terms of podcasting, stand by it.
I mean, I will say, I think we would only be improved by you listening to podcasts, but I do think it's a little bit different because I think that reading really helps your writing. I don't know that listening always helps your talking per se, but I do think it would be worth it just to know, like, for example, oh, look, all these podcasts that people like really invest time and energy into, they come out on a regular basis. Maybe there's a lesson there.
Yeah. Maybe if we had a schedule. Something like that.
Who knows?
That we stuck to
instead
much
of just
like
surprising
much
people.
Much like a band practice.
People yeah, who you know people what? Who subscribe to our stuff is like, oh, there's a new. Oh, look at that. There's a new. I didn't know. Wasn't expected that. You know. Oh, look.
It's
there's
like
a new
waking
episode.
Up
wow.
with your head sewn to the carpet. Yeah, I get it. I get it. I'm not even mad at it. But that said, I do listen to The Bald and the Beautiful, but starring Trixie Mattel and Katya because that
you
shit
did.
Is
you
dope.
Did tell me that. You did tell me that. Yes.
Yeah. You know that.
I mean,
that show rules.
Look. Look, you just reminded me, I have a podcast to talk about in my Whacking on Track, so we'll get there in a sec. But first, we want to say thank you. First and foremost, of course, to you, our listener, and especially those of you who are not just listeners, but patrons, and who have gone over to patreon.com/cinepunks to support us on Patreon, to give whether it's $1 a month or $20 a month, to make sure that this endeavor keeps going. We really love you. We just posted something. There's a thing we're doing coming up, which we won't directly talk about on the show, but it's a thing. And if you are a patron, you know about this thing, and you are invited to this thing, and we hope you will come. virtually attend. We don't want to have anyone think that we're risking COVID. This is a virtual event. But it's only
so mysterious. It's shrouded in mystery.
Here's the thing. You want to know what it is? Patreon.com.
No, you have to Patreon.
Yeah. That's what I was doing. That's what I was doing, Josh. Anyways,
I didn't pick up the lead. Yeah, my
we
bad.
Really do.
My
we really do appreciate you all, and we hope you feel it. And we're hoping to do even more for y'all to enjoy in the future. Okay. We also, of course, want to thank our friends over at Lehigh Valley Apparel Creations. Now, Josh. Let's say I started a band that was somewhere between let's say, integrity and
Lady Gaga.
Lady Gaga. Uh-huh. I was just looking for another kind of rock music, but you took me in a whole other direction. And I had these sick idea for screen printed long underwear bottoms. Right. Where would you send me to get that printed?
Funny you should mention. I would send you to the expert of bottoms, the Lehigh Valley Apparel Creations mogul, Chris Reject. That's where I go. I'd be like, Chris Reject, you're known in the bottoms community. Here are some sick merch ideas for my friend's new Integrity Gaga band that are called Integrity Gaga. What do you got for me? Boom. Done. Look at that. You're welcome.
I wish I knew more Lady Gaga titles so I could combine Humanity as the Devil with something. You know what I mean?
I think my next tattoo is going to just be the Integrity skull, and it's going to say Chromatica is the Devil. It's the greatest record that's been put out ever.
Holy Terror. There's got to be something with combining Holy Terror and some Lady Gaga thing.
Oh, like, man.
Born This Terrible, or I don't know. I don't fucking know. Anyways, head over to xlvacx.com. Here's the thing. I'm sure that lots of people listening to this who are like, I don't have anything I need to get screen printed. Bullshit. Come up with something.
I was actually thinking, since listeners of the show will know, your boy Josh is starting college virtually next Tuesday.
Yep.
And I was thinking about funny t-shirts that I could get made for all the Zoom classes I'll be taking. And the greatest one that I've come up with is simply Zoom, Zoom, Zoom. Let me hear you say wayo. And then in parentheses, wayo.
That's actually.
So I thought
you could have also gone with. You could have also gone with. All I want to do is zoom a zoom 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 and a boom boom, and then in parentheses, just shake your rump.
Or it would be funnier if it just says, all I want to do is zoom a zoom 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 and a zoom zoom, and don't do boom boom, but zoom zoom at the end.
Oh my God, we're the worst. This has become an old uncle's podcast.
You know what?
Call up your washed uncle and play him this podcast so that we have.
This,
like,
is totally why we should not have microphones. That's the truth.
Our podcast just bought chicletas. Is what just happened.
Chicletas.
and a sick like straw fedora.
Sick guayabara. Yeah. It's a dope look. That's all I'm saying, man. College boy.
Okay, so we also want to thank our friends over at Essex Coffee Roasters. Look, we're going to do this one really quick. Essex gives you affordable, high-quality coffee roasted to order. When you buy it, you're supporting Aaron Dahlbeck, who's the coolest. They also have cool merch and cool tea. If you put in the code Cinepunks, CINEPUNX, you get 10% off. Done and done. Multiple people got the coffee for Cross Keys because you have a million fans because everybody loves you. And they all were like, oh, man, this coffee's pretty good. I replied to four different messages. Yo, next time, use the Cinepunks code. And all these people were like, oh, I didn't know about that. Fuck you. Mm. You should know about it. Use the Cinepunks code. Get your 10% off, you piece of shit. And support Essex Coffee because it's really good coffee made by people that you love. So we're done there. That's
the
done.
Funny thing is, I was trying to do cross promo with the Cross Keys stuff. And I was like, oh, yeah, you can use Cinepunks for like a 10% discount. And Band Daddy Andrew was just like, Josh, you know that this is a fundraiser, right? Like, you know. That's why I haven't been pushing the Cinepunks promo. I was like, oh, die. But
oh yeah, let's be clear. I'm saying now that they've gotten it, they could use the promo, and a lot of people just didn't know it existed because they all had me muted on social media. That's why they didn't know it existed.
That's so good. Oh snap! But yeah. Essex Coffee Roasted for all your coffee needs. Those dudes are the Earl Aaron is the best. So. Holler at our dude. And incidentally, in relation to the Cross Keys Essex Coffee promotion thing, we managed to raise $350 for the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project, who works to keep children out of adult jails and prisons. So went to a good cause, and thank you to everybody who participated and who bought and gave us your money for that stuff. That shit is awesome. Thank you.
Good
so
work,
much.
Josh. Good work.
Again. Band Daddy did it, not me. It's Andrew Welbrock, the best dude in the world. But go on.
I mean, he kind of is, actually.
I know. He's like my superhero. I'm going to get a back piece of just Andrew in a trench coat.
I kind of wish he didn't listen to the show so I could say nice things about him and know that he wouldn't hear it.
He listens to us.
I know. He's going to be like, Liam thinks I'm the best dude. I don't. Screw you, Andrew. It's not true. I do think he's the best dude. He's so good. Okay.
Man.
All right. Let's go on here, Josh. There's something that we got to do because we do it every episode. And we kind of mildly skipped it last episode. So now I kind of don't remember how it goes.
So much of a thing. There was a thing on last episode that we were thinking of. So it was kind of hard to think about this thing that we did. That being a little segment that we like to call Whacking on Track.
Oh, you threw me off so bad. I literally took a big breath, and while I was taking the breath to yell it, you just did it. And I was like, well, there we go. We're done.
I was thinking of the head of Barbera, Whacking on Track.
Whacking on Track. Hey there, everybody.
Oh, poor Jacob. I'm so sorry.
Can you believe that I'm not a voice actor? Listen to that crazy work that I'm doing. And yet,
of all the things that I can't believe, you not being a voice actor is definitely one of the utmost of the things. You know what I'm saying?
I like to call this character Derwillicky Doodad.
Mostly because when people talk to you, they think they're talking to a cartoon anyway.
Well, yeah, but they usually think it's like one of those cartoons that makes you feel bad or something. Yeah, you know,
Grave of the Firefly style.
Yeah,
that tracks. So, Liam, what have you done recently that is whack? Or what have you done that is on track?
Well, let's go ahead and say, my whack is going to be very often the continued state of our nation and political situation. You'd think that a week after an insurrection, we'd be able to be like, yo, these things happened that, like, at least are making things better. And that's, like, hasn't been a thing. So that's continued turmoil there. That's definitely a whack.
Continued whackness is what we like to call it on this show, Liam.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's actual bullshit. Makes me very mad, actually. As far as on track, I watched a movie with my wife called Palm Springs. Do you know about this movie?
Oh, yeah. I loved it.
Yeah. I don't know why I didn't catch it. I'm actually unaware.
Are you not an Andy Samberg dude? Like, you
I am.
You're not, like, a fan. Oh, are you?
I didn't. Oh, no. I am a lonely...
I think just because I think of your aversion towards all things fun, I was like, oh, there's no way Liam would love
Stop.
This stuff. It's super
I
fun.
Was such a, I was such a big proponent of pop star never stop, never stopping, that I can't believe that you would not know, A, that I love fun, and B, that I love Andy Samberg. I have watched all those Lonely Planet videos from back in the day, or Lonely Island, rather. Lonely Island videos from back in the day, over and over again. What's interesting about this movie, this isn't a Lonely Island production, but this was not written or directed by the Lonely Island fellas. It just stars Andy Samberg, and then they produced it. And I thought that was interesting, and I wonder if it lent itself to being more of a grounded story actually about something, which a lot of their movies aren't, but still having that taste of extreme comedy that really worked. And I got to tell you guys, the movie's fucking funny. And that's huge for me because if people listen to either of the episodes I did related to last year, not a lot of funny movies on my list. I just didn't find a lot of funny movies very good.
That's so strange, given that your predilection towards fun is so renowned.
Oh my god! I love funny movies. I can quote Hot Rod from memory. All right, I still remember parts of Top Secret. I can do large sections of Top Secret from memory. All right. Don't question my funny bone here.
It's so
you
funny.
Sons of guns.
Oh, sweet Jesus. Yeah. Everybody knows our fun-loving contributor, Liam.
Stop. I hate you so much. I am very fun.
I know. You're the funnest.
First of all,
but come on.
I don't know where you get off. You're the sad sack writing sad songs all the time about how sad you are. You don't see me doing that.
Show of hands. Who saw Lonely Island live in concert with his wife? Show of hands.
That's just because you have money.
Raised.
Now you're confusing. Now you're confusing your class privilege. You're confusing your class privilege with being fun. I'd love to go see Lonely Island. I don't have dollars.
I'll admit that it was the closest I've ever come to being at an actual frat party. There were people vaping. There were people vaping shit. In the crowd. Oh, yeah, fuck yeah, that. Buddy, that happened.
Anyway, let's get back to it. For those of you who maybe are skeptical about this movie, Palm Springs is, yes, it is related to Groundhog Day, but it is nothing like Groundhog Day because it's, though it is a time loop movie, it's not a movie that's focused the way that Groundhog Day is on kind of getting things right. There's no like moral to it per se, you know, like it does end up about character growth, but not in this sort of cosmic way that Groundhog Day is. And it's just different enough that like it lives on its own and it has its own world and it never feels like a ripoff. In fact, it is related to it enough and separate enough that they could have mentioned Groundhog Day in this movie and it wouldn't have felt weird. You would have been like, oh yeah, yeah. Sure. But they don't. But you know what I mean? But also J.K. Simmons in it is next level.
He's so good. Oh, he's so good in it. Yeah.
And the young lady who's in it, I've only seen her in a few things, but one of those things was How I Met Your Mother. And I remember the brief stint she had on that show, I felt like she was wildly underused, just like truly not taken seriously. And it really was one of the many things that bummed me out about that show. It was like, oh, I just feel like that character needed a better treatment than what sort of happens to her. And so to see her in this movie being so funny and so fun and just really kind of like carrying the movie as much as Andy Samberg did. Like, I love Andy Samberg, but like he oftentimes takes a back seat to her. And
her name is Kristen Milioti.
Yeah. By the way, Josh, from Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Oh, graduated snap.
Graduated from East. So she's a little younger than us, so I don't think you would have met her. But she is from similar soil to you, so keep that in mind.
I'm quite sure that the reason that I probably wouldn't have met her is not because she's younger, but mostly because we were also socially awkward and addicted to Gorilla Biscuits at the time that nobody registered.
Sure.
And that's just what that is. I'm okay with it.
I also love that I read up her trivia and her Wikipedia, and one of the funny things about it to me was like, it was like, you know, Cherry Hill, New Jersey, blah, 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 went to NYU, dropped out after 1 year. It says in the Wikipedia, I think it was Wikipedia, it might be IMDb, dropped out after only 1 year at NYU, but is still featured in promotional materials. It's such a bitter thing to put in your, like maybe someone else put it, but I'm sure it's, you know, whoever it is.
It's pretty funny. Yeah, pretty, pretty good.
Anyways, I thought it was really good, and I think it's worth recommending to people if you haven't had a chance to. I also, I haven't talked about it much, but I finished that show Schitt's Creek. That a lot of people are obsessed with. I finished it.
Yeah.
That's one of those shows, I think.
We only got to, like, season, like, two of it. I think me and Milani got to season two, and we didn't finish season two of Schitt's Creek. For no reason other than we just stopped watching it.
Well, I think it has a bit of a backlash because the fan base is obsessive. But what's great about it for me and Suze is we kind of missed all that. Like, we obviously it was obsessive enough that we heard about the show, but we kind of missed a lot of the fervor, the really obsessive stuff. So by the time we finish the show and then there's a thing on Netflix that's like a wrap up of the end of the show. Like it's like a special about the show being over. And in that special, they kind of show the like depth of the fan base. And I honestly was like, oh, I'm so glad I missed all of that because it would have turned me off to the show. So people who like don't like the show just on principle because you just don't like the fan base, like I totally get it. But I think that the show's actually very good. I understand that it does take a little bit to like really get its feet. But I think it's charming from the beginning. It just goes from charming to very good. So like, you know, maybe charming is not enough for people, but I think if you stick with it, it does get very good. And we were really happy with it. And like, for me, I'm not really a half hour comedy guy, but because like the way our life is, we don't always have a lot of time at night to watch something longer. We've had to find half hour comedies of some kind that like I want to watch. So I was so happy when we found this one because there's not a lot out there that I enjoy in that realm. So Schitt's Creek, I recommend it. I think it's really, really good. Okay, Josh, how about you? What do you have that's either whack or on track?
All right. Well, whack again, the world. On track, Okay, here's the thing. Do you ever get that thing where you just have to watch action movies?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Action movies, not like, you know, Andy Sidera's action movies of like, oh, these like, you know, whatever, like, you know, like those, what was the one movie that we watched? The Miami one?
Hard Ticket to Hawaii.
Hard Ticket to Hawaii. And like all those things, like I get those, but I'm talking about stuff that's coming out now, like action movies that are current.
Oh, almost never.
Almost never, right? So Melania and I had a tear where we watched The Doorman from 2020 starring Ruby Rose and Jean Reno and directed by Ryuhei Kitamura, who, as you know, is like, I think that's the guy who directed Versus. He directed a bunch of those like early at the beginning of like Asian movies.
I think
like,
Yakuza Weapon is one of the ones he did. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
might be wrong. Don't quote me on that. I might be wrong about that.
But anyway, so yeah, we watched this movie about a doorman played by Ruby Rose, who she is ex-military. She goes through some type of like these people are in her care and they manage to get killed while she's watching them, and like so she ends up leaving the army or whatever, and she becomes a doorman at a hotel that her uncle works in, right? Because she needs a job and she's not working in the military anymore. So, you know, she's like, well, I'll work as a doorman. And lo and behold, Jean Reno is actually trying to do a caper in the very hotel that she just was hired at to steal these paintings that he had that were like Rembrandts and shit. And he got them through some type of ill-begotten means, and then he hid them. Well, like this partner stole them. The story's a little wonky if we're being honest with each other. Like some dude got them and then he hid them in the walls of this apartment in this building where Ruby Rose is the doorman to. You follow that?
Yes.
Did you get all that? Yeah. Okay. So then what ends up happening is, the bad guys come in and there's an elderly couple, and the dude, the father of the elderly couple, the dude partner, he's in a wheelchair. He had a stroke, but he's the dude who end up with the paintings. So, you know, they shoot them and try and find out where the paintings are. And they find out that, oh, they happen to be in the old apartment that they used to live in, which Ruby Rose's family happens to live in. So, you know, she's working in a building with her estranged family, and then they go, and then all this stuff happens, and then she has to go full Navy SEAL on them to protect her family and to retrieve the paintings from Jean Reno. Now, on its face, okay, I'm with it. Let's do this. You know what I'm saying? I don't know anything about Ruby Rose, or at least I didn't. I only remembered her from John Wick 2, another epic titan of cinematic history, and she didn't talk in that movie and because she was deaf, but in this one she's not deaf, so that was acting on her part in the John Wick movie. And yeah, this movie is there's problems in it, but I was into it. It was fun. It was just a bunch of like kind of dumb stuff. There's a moment where mint sauce for pork chops is spilled by one of the children, and it's sure. Oh man, it's one of those flicks where you're like, all these things are here and I'm so surprised that they're all here, but none of them are working in concert with the other.
Can I just jump in real quick?
Yeah.
Your man Ryuhei Kitamura,
yeah,
also directed Godzilla Final Wars.
Wow. He also did Sky High. He did Azumi? Like all of those. Oh, Azumi, yeah, I loved Azumi.
He did one of a million interpretations of Lupin the Third. This one featuring an entire Japanese cast. Interesting choice for a French character. And then very recently did a movie that I actually not loved, but kind of enjoyed, that I saw at a friend of the show, Josh Goldblum's Fest, Cinepocalypse, called Downrange. I had no idea.
I remember that one, yeah.
No idea that was
him.
The
Shudder had that.
Yeah. Let's see, what else did he do? Oh, he also did, weirdly, and I had no idea, the Midnight Meat Train movie from 2008.
Oh, with the British dude, the skinhead guy.
Yeah, this guy does a lot of suits. Kitamura has done a lot of interesting stuff. Like, he's kind of all over the place. He just 2 years ago did Nightmare Cinema. Maybe he was one of the directors on Nightmare Cinema, because I think that's a
anthology. And that's the thing. Like, I like Kitamura. Like, I liked the older movies by him that I saw. And, you know, did he do Versus?
I think on rewatch, Versus is bad. I think it's a bad movie.
Really?
Yeah. Not only did I rewatch it, I saw it in a theater, right, with the star in attendance and with a new soundtrack. They basically recut it to a new soundtrack because the old soundtrack, as you remember, is the same techno drop over and over and over and over and over again for 2 hours. Mm. And so they recut it to like new music. And it's not that good. It's not terrible. And I think at the time, it was just the fact that there was even a zombie movie with martial arts was like, our brains exploded. But on rewatch, it's like, I'd rather watch Tokyo Gore Police, or you know what I mean? Like, I think the gore explosion Japanese movies that came after, not all of them, but a lot of them are actually better than Versus, which I would not have said previously. So,
but he did do No One Lives in 2012.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good too.
That movie is super fun. I enjoyed that one. So,
Anyway, I'm going to watch it on your recommendation alone. I'm going to watch it.
Yeah, it's got problems. It's not a perfect movie, but it's also, I don't know, a movie to watch.
It's a movie. That's what we're known for here at CinePunks, recommending movies that you could watch, maybe.
Movie to watch. You know what I'm saying? That's kind of our deal, you know? And then we went from that in our action tear to another movie from 2019 called Primal. Do you know about this movie?
Nope.
It's a Nicolas Cage movie. It's also starring Famke Janssen. Nicolas Cage is a big game hunter, and he finds a white jaguar that he puts on a boat that happens to have a bad guy on the boat.
No.
And then the bad guy gets away, and then, you know, they got to hunt the bad guy on the boat. Oh, man, I don't really need to say anything further, I think. But you know that clearly lands in the on-track pile.
Because, I'm going to go with that's actually a secret whack. That's what I'm going to say.
That's great. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah. Those are the two things that I watched that I was into. And, you know, if that discredits me from my movie card, then, hey, guess what? Let's do that. So, you know. And one of the other things that I've done that's on track is that friend of the show, Pat Engelman, has supplied me with a workout regimen. I asked him, I was like, yo, dude, like, I'm going to be doing school this semester. Like, I need a workout regimen to get shredded. So he supplied me with a bunch of exercises that we have titled Shred the Josh. And it's a 25-minute workout every day with a 20-minute stretch beforehand. And you know what else is 25 minutes long? A little record by a band called Madball called Set It Off. So I listen to Set It Off, and I do this workout, and it's pretty dope. So big up to Pat for that, and that's on track.
I'm into that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that's where I'm at. That's what we're doing.
The one thing I did remember that I forgot was just some podcasts recently have been really great. Recent episodes of Axe to Grind, Behind the Bastards. I'm really into the new I wouldn't say new, but the most recent story on Adventure Zone. So I've just been really like amazed with podcasts lately and really enjoying them. And so I wanted to shout that out, and I especially wanted to shout out, there's a few podcasts that like we're friends with, whether that's Final Girls Horror Cast or The Horror Show or Nerds of Nostalgia. There's just a few podcasts that, like, you know, friends of ours are on. I like to movie. And so I just wanted to, you know, say, hey, podcasts are pretty cool. And you should check them out. I do think we're one of those few podcasts that we know for a fact there are people who listen to our podcast who don't listen to podcasts. Like, they're just like, yeah, my friend's got one, and that's it. That's all I like is that one that Josh and Liam do. And that's fine. And I love you. But I do like some other podcasts, so I figured I'd spread the love a little bit.
Oh, also on the music front, the something that happened last week that is new for me is the first two records by Adam and His Package have hit all streaming platforms, including Bandcamp.
Sure.
So A Society of People Named Elihu and The Self-Titled are now available for your streaming needs. And you know what? I like it. No, I love it.
Yeah, you're a big Adam fan.
Yeah, big up to the homeboy Adam Gorin and that crew, and listen to those records if you if you're so inclined to listen to crust punk inspired synth pop from the early 2000s.
I mean, we put the Where Eagles Dare cover on the last episode, so
it's such a good great cover. Anyway, so yeah, so that's what we do.
So we never actually said what this episode was going to be about. Me and Josh don't think because we host a film podcast that we don't have holes in our film knowledge. We have a bunch, and that's fine. We have a lot of listeners who are more casual film fans, and they might feel intimidated to admit like, oh, I don't know about this or I don't know about that. And the reality is there's nothing wrong with admitting when there's stuff you don't know about, because no one, no matter how cool they may seem or maybe lame they may seem, depending on how you feel about movie watching, no one's seen all the movies. It's just not real. No one can know everything. And on this show, we really emphasize our enthusiasm and our passion over our expertise, because we're not experts. And one of the many directors we are not experts about is John Cassavetes, a gentleman who I've seen act in many movies and had never watched a single movie he directed, not even once. And so me and Josh were thinking, how do we want to start the new year? And we thought, let's start with something, some topic, director, movies that we like don't know a lot about. And John Cassavetes was a good option. So on this episode, we're going to be talking about Faces and A Woman Under the Influence. What years are those from again? Do you remember?
Woman Under the Influence is 1974, and Faces is 19...
I think it was released in 68.
68, yeah.
Yeah, but it was made up for a while. I was watching it going, this doesn't feel like 1968, and then I was watching the making of, and it took them like 3 years to get it out or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I was
yeah,
like,
yeah,
okay,
it was
that
all
makes
done.
A little
yeah.
more sense. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We'll get to it, yes. Yeah.
Anyways, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about 1968's Faces, directed by well-known actor and also well-known director, John Cassavetes.
After the break.
Stop now, come on.
And we're back.
Hello.
Hello. So today we're talking about John Cassavetes movies. Specifically, we're talking about Faces and A Woman Under the Influence. And so let's talk about John Cassavetes real quick. Why do you think that this was a good topic to talk about, Liam?
So a lot of people talk about John Cassavetes as being not the beginning, but one of the first sort of auteurs in the independent movement in the United States, and about how his films were a big influence on a lot of the French New Wave, and really about how he's one of these first people who would act to pay for his directing. You know, by the time he starts directing, which was in the later 50s, early 60s, he was already established as an actor. He was already respected as an actor. Mm-hmm. And he started directing almost like on a whim, you know what I mean? After studying certain schools of acting and really thinking about what he wanted to make, he started directing. And I just think there's something, you know, I'm not really a rah-rah America person, but there is something very America about this guy saying, well, I've got all this money and I could just live rich off this money, or I could spend it all to make the movies I want. And not exclusively, like some of his films were funded by studios, but a lot of his movies weren't that at all, because no one would pay him to make these movies. Even when the movies got critical acclaim, no one wanted to make these movies. No one wanted to pay for these movies. And there's something inspiring about that.
The legend is that in 1958, John Cassavetes was teaching a method acting class at NYU. And he was directing a play for the class that he suggested was like, you know, this is good movie material. And after suggesting it to the board of the acting department at NYU, he ended up fundraising $20,000 to make this movie. And then that ended up being half of it. And then the other half he got from fundraising amongst his Hollywood friends. Because like we said, by 58, he had already been established as like an actor, like on TV and film. And he managed to, between contributions from his celebrity friends and from his own savings, he managed to put out Shadows in 1958, which was his first movie. And that was truly from the whim of him just being like, you know, this should be a movie, while he was teaching students. So that's kind of how, like, he got his start, just, like, almost flippantly. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And lo and behold, he's the progenitor of what's known as cinema verite now, which honestly is a thing that people throw out that I'm like, I remember when I first heard it when we were in the Film Society, and I was like, huh. Wonder what that means. And then, like, you know, when we were starting Cinepunks, you and I had talked about mise-en-scene and, like, all these other, like, movie terms and stuff. I'm like, ah, yes, cinema verite, like John Cassavetes. But I had no idea what the fuck that was talking about. And after watching these two movies, I'm not so sure I still know about what that is.
Oh, yeah? Than, okay.
You know, shaky hand cam. But, I mean, like, you know, he started and, like, well, the funny thing is that Faces, just like Shadows, is shot in 16mm in a handy, you know, hand cam, you know, and perhaps that is, I mean, like I've read, I know what the internet says cinema verite is and its earmarks and all that stuff. So, you know, and I get it, but also it's not like I'd be like, oh, yes, in that very cinema verite style. You know what I mean? I would never say that because I'm not a dork. Holla at your boy. Totally cool. But anyway. But yeah, no, these, I think that this is a really interesting topic for us to talk about, just because it's really funny when we go to things like Cassavetes, when we go to things like Fellini, when we go to things like just that these staples of cinematic phylogeny that then ends up becoming just part and parcel of what it is that we love currently. You know what I mean? Like, so then when you see like the DNA strands at the beginning of this that lead to a Wes Anderson, that lead to, like, you know, movies that we love that are being made now, it's just funny to see the correlation of, like, just, you know, it's like hearing Gorilla Biscuits before you hear Civ, but you start at Civ. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same thing. I shouldn't talk about GB anymore. But
yeah, you're obsessed to talk about GB.
I've been thinking about them a lot today, and I don't know why. I've been listening to it. It's a thing. I've been listening to that and Lady Gaga all day today. So,
wow. You know. That's so far from anywhere I've been.
Yeah, man. That Robin. Oh man, I love Robin so much.
But well, I mean, I do love Robin. But no, I mean, I think the thing that I was thinking in relation to the to this is remembering that when these movies came out, that they were at least somewhat unique. I'm sure there were some examples of people doing similar things, but this style. So, like, what you know, what Cassavetes is doing that I think is unique is a yes. In order for him to get the shots he wants and the feeling he wants, it's all handheld. It's all this 60 millimeter, and it's difficult because it's hard to focus. Like the way that these actors are kind of doing whatever the fuck they want and really like going with the flow. How do you maintain focus? How do you maintain lighting? Like, one of the things people seem to forget is how technical filming things is, and that might be partly inspired by the fact that with our phones now, we can do a lot of stuff that looks kind of cool, so we forget that that wasn't always the case. So the idea in some of these rooms and in these houses that people are running back and forth and we're able to even see what they're doing, that's like kind of insane in some ways, you know? But also, that wasn't the point. The point for him was to have a film, a kind of film and a kind of narrative that was about small emotions, that were about everyday interactions, that were about humans, you know? And what I realized watching this is part of what was so revolutionary about Faces, particularly, let's focus on that one right now. For those of you who haven't seen it, Faces is about domestic relationships among a certain kind of white middle America, although it was filmed in California. I think it's meant to represent a kind of middle America and a kind of like middle class, like maybe probably upper middle class, really.
Middle class, because you get the sense that these characters are accustomed to a certain like bourgeois way of life.
Right, right. Yeah. And but the idea that at a later point in life, the sort of feelings of frustration, you know, your kid hasn't turned out the way you want them to be, so you're mad at the world, you want to be out having fun, that all of the husbands and all of the wives are sexually frustrated, but they're unwilling to figure that out together. There's all of this stuff that, like, I'm sure feels very cliche now. Like, I think that's part of the thing I realized watching Faces, is how much of Faces feels cliche, and then you stop and go, oh, wait, right. No one had really done it like this. That. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That, in fact, it's groundbreaking because people hadn't seen stories like this. They hadn't seen, this is the kind of melodrama that's not melodramatic. It's a story about interactions, and those interactions are more relatable. But even more so, there's a huge gap between the way people lived then and the way people live now. And I imagine watching Faces with a Gen Z person would be an unbelievable experience, because I don't think they would understand anything that was happening. Some of the ways that people were interacting in this movie, Josh, I was like, okay, I got to put on my historical hat right now to understand why people are acting this way. Well, because there's so much hang up. I mean, one of the most telling moments. So there's only a few characters here. We've got these two men who are friends who end up at the house of a single woman. And it's almost impossible for married men to interact with a single woman in a way that doesn't assume that she's a prostitute. Like, just being single made you morally questionable. And then as that goes forward, one of those men, we stay with him as he is around his wife, who I think is meant to be much younger than him and was much younger as far as the age of the actors. But she's frustrated with him. He's frustrated with her. He finally like wants a divorce. And then we see the same woman that he had spent time with the night before is with these other people. And what I found really telling is when this new man that she's hanging out with, he's vulnerable with her. And like, that's partly what he needed, right? It's like going to a sex worker, right? And paying them to listen to you because you don't know how else to feel listened to, which again, probably feels in the age of the internet, feels like a foreign idea, but was pretty common, honestly, up until when we were first becoming adults. That was still a thing people did. And really, that's the interaction that this man has. But then he can't let his friend know that they haven't fucked or at least made out. So then he pretends to come out of the room like he was just fooling around, even though all he was doing was making himself emotional. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
There's this performative masculinity that I think, not that there aren't strains of it, like performative toxic masculinity still exists, but the way it existed then is so fucking different than the way it exists now. Yeah. That I bet there's a whole generation of people that would have trouble relating to this movie, relating to the way people talk to each other, relating to the hangups that they have, relating to the all of it. Even like when he comes home and finds his wife with this other man, just the idea, like, these are two people getting a divorce, really, you know, or at least separated, and this man has to run out the roof. And by the way, considering that this is a handheld independent feature with no tracking or whatever, that's one of the better shots I've seen in a movie, when he comes running across that roof and jumps down and runs out onto the road. I was like,
I mean, let's not forget the fact that that is the young Seymour Cassell, watches or listen to the show, remember, from a little movie called Rushmore that we both love. And it's just funny seeing young Seymour Cassell as like,
well, this is like, was his like start. He loved him and John were great friends, and he was in most of John Cassavetes' movies.
So cool just seeing him like just as like the Lothario of the night for the three ladies is just
seeing him so young. I was like, God, he was hot when he was a young man. Like, I totally believe that, so being brutal. So into him.
Man.
So he has a whole room. I mean, as we're seeing things develop with this husband character, the wife is with her girlfriends. They go to the Whiskey Go-Go. They bring home this dude. They go to
a
dance club,
and they bring home a dude who has jazz records with him, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
He says he's from Detroit, and he's got jazz records. And it's like three, just, you know, we would say, like, I'd say middle-aged women. And then this young, strapping jazz enthusiast from Detroit, who's a free spirit that they meet at the dance club. You know what I mean? They bring him home, and then all this like weird interactions start happening between the four of them. Right? Yeah, there's four.
Yeah.
It gets sketch at that point where I'm just like, whoa, this whole thing is like really weird. And it's like, people related to each other?
Yeah, it is. I think it is, though. Like, watching it, I thought it was a little sketch, but then I thought, imagine being a sexually frustrated 40-year-old woman, 45, 50. The one woman, I think, is 60-year-old woman.
Yeah.
You feel ignored by your husband. You've been out on this night on the town. There's this hot young man, and you're feeling
all drinking. Yeah, carousing.
Well, and it's hard to understand how it was to relate in this situation when there's so many hangups and expectations and mores. It was an act. This was a time when it felt like this is controversial to say, but I just think it's true. This is a time where it felt oftentimes like an act of adultery wasn't just a betrayal. It was also like, I don't know, kind of heroic, because the whole society thought any sex of any kind outside of marriage, even if you weren't married, was like horrible. You know, like, people were still catching on. I mean, we can say like, oh, this is 60s, the time of free love. Free love getting to the suburbs was a long way off. You know, that wasn't a thing. Getting
to the middle-aged housewife is also not a thing that was happening at that time. Yeah, for sure.
And let's keep in mind, too, films didn't focus on women of this age. Like, I mean, I would say some of these women aren't as old as we would. Like, right now, to be like a fun and frisky 35-year-old is like normal, right? I'm 41, and I know plenty of people my age who are like, I don't need to settle down. I'm still living my life.
I'm out here living life.
And I think that's fine. But that wasn't normal, and it certainly wasn't normal for a film to honestly
capture
these women. And I'll be honest, leer at them a little bit. Like, in that scene, they're like meant to look alluring, and like, that's like a little controversial for the time. But I think that what he's doing is capturing their frustration, their excitement, and the fact that like they're real people, that like being a wife and a mother doesn't actually eliminate your humanity. You know, not necessarily that all of them are mothers, but you know what I mean? Like, that just because they had followed what they were told to do and signed on to this domestic life doesn't mean that their life had ended. But in this society, there weren't a lot of options for these women to explore all that life had to offer.
Yeah, man.
So what did
you think about, like, we talked about a little bit about that one shot of John Cassavetes jumping off of the roof. But what did you think about the visual style?
You mean
Seymour Cassell. Sorry. What did you think about the visual style of this movie? What was your reaction to it?
I mean, in some ways it felt very familiar, because we've seen a lot of movies more recently that do this sort of thing, and it's easier to do now with the technology that we have. But I liked it. I found it interesting. I know. Well, and let's be clear. I think the filming of it, because his first movie, Shadows, is completely improvised, people then thought all of his movies were completely improvised. And they weren't. They were heavily scripted. They were even blocked out. But where he believed in improvisation was within a scene. So, like, if we're doing the lines we're meant to do, and I feel like I want to move a certain way or I want to do something a certain way, like, within the moment of the scene, he would just film it. And if he didn't like it, we'd do it again, you know? And he would do it a bunch of times. And whatever he liked, he would keep. And whatever he didn't like ended up on the editing room floor. And that's how people do movies a lot of times. Like, that's not that different than what... I mean, it's different then, because when I was watching the making of, a lot of the actors that he worked with were like, we weren't allowed that kind of freedom. Like, we just had to hit our mark and that was it. And so, like, it's so I say all that to say, part of the improvisation, because these actors are moving on take 10, they're moving differently than they were on take 2. You just have to respond to that as a cameraman. So do I think that that kind of style where they're not always in focus perfectly, not everything is lit perfectly, I kind of love it. You know, I kind of think it really works. There's this moment where he's chasing her as she runs upstairs, and as he follows her in the house, he's turning off lights, and I bet he's doing that just because they were like, as you leave the room, turn off the light, just so we don't have that as a distracting thing for the camera. But what it does is create a really magical shot of him standing in the light while she's kind of in the dark. Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah. It's so awesome, too. And the other thing that I noticed while watching Faces, and also I noticed it a little, not as prominent in A Woman Under the Influence, but you could tell that when the more emotional, the more emotionally grave moments happen in the movie, with the handheld style, he does these very close shots on the faces that happen through as the revelations happen throughout the movie. And I thought that was very compelling in terms of using the camera as a character, and just the director, Cassavetes, genuine direction of the person's eye, of the viewer's eye, to where the movie is happening. You understand what I'm saying? And so in addition to the handheld, but then the close shots as the emotional drama plays out, mostly in the faces of these people, it's such an interesting way to see a movie, I think. And he nails it in this movie. Like, it's just, it's a thing that you realize has been used. Like, you see a movie like Son of Solomon, and you get it, it's all done in close-up, so that's a thing. But this movie has that, again, that DNA. You could tell it started in this kind of concept.
Yeah, the close-ups are unbelievable. And watching that behind-the-scenes footage, or the interviews, rather, the one actress was saying how it was weird for her when she went home because suddenly cameras weren't in her face all the time. You know what I mean? It felt so natural to play the characters and just have these cameras just on you that, being away from set was actually a little bit more jarring. Yeah, I love that. I actually love that style. Like, don't get me wrong. The Kubricks of the world who are setting up their shot and it's all symmetrical, that's fine. I love that.
The tatami shots and all.
I like it. Even John Carpenter does a lot of these sort of solid long shots, whatever. But I also love that handheld close up, man. If you're doing it, if you know why you're doing it, if it doesn't feel like, well, I just don't know what I'm doing, that doesn't feel this. This feels like he's capturing very real emotions, which is, again, is a part of the movie. Not that there aren't big emotions as well, but these are about those small moments that can lead to those big emotions, you know?
Yeah. And I think it also speaks to his pedigree as a method actor and championing style of acting, because it's a total inhabitation. You know what I mean? These roles aren't so much played out. And that's what gives it that whole, maybe this isn't scripted feel, that these roles are inhabited by these people.
I mean, that's what they all describe, is they describe they would rehearse, but the rehearsal was more like a table read. And what they weren't allowed to do was ever talk about their roles outside of the film. So like they would read and read and read and read and read, and then they block just a little bit with the idea that the blocking was a little bit loose, and then they would film and they would shoot, you know, scenes multiple times. You know, none of them described it as tiresome, but that he would be very much like, okay, this worked, or no, this isn't working. Let's just stop. Considering he paid for this movie out of his pocket, they were saying like the number of times he would just stop and be like, it's not working today, we'll start tomorrow. It's like crazy to me, because that's like a wasted day. That's thousands of dollars out of your pocket.
Yeah.
But especially he would like
in the day and age of film stock, dude.
Yeah.
That's fucking crazy.
They would start every day doing like they were saying, like, because basically what happened with Simon Cassell is that he wasn't
Seymour Cassell.
He wasn't in the movie till later. So he started off on set as part of the like set crew. And then at some point he had to transition from set crew to acting. And they were saying like the first 3 days of shooting, Cassavetes would just stop because he just didn't like what Seymour was doing. He just wasn't on point. And then one day they never even got to shoot. He just was like, they were doing like their table read and he was like, no, this isn't working. We'll just start tomorrow. And then the next day, Seymour came in like totally primed, like ready to go, because he's like, I'm not wasting another day, you know. But, you know, I love that. The idea that like, and granted, yes, this is a mark of privilege. Let's all admit that making a movie is a mark of privilege. And if you have the money, blah, blah, blah. Yes. But the idea that he was using that privilege and that money and those resources to say, we're going to make something good. We're not going to just get the shot and hope it's all right. I have to feel good about it, and we all have to feel good about it. And the fact that for him, his style of directing was like, once he gave an actor the script, the character was theirs. He didn't get to tell them, like, this is what you don't know about this character. You own the character, and that performance is yours. And like, he may or may not like it, but he's not going to tell you what it is about it that's wrong. He's just going to tell you when he believes it or not, you know?
Mm, yeah.
I love that. Awesome, I fucking love it. Yeah. So yeah, I thought this movie is not an easy watch. I want to back up a little bit and be clear. Like,
oh yeah,
the authenticity and the reality of the emotions of this film make it like really hard to watch and at times almost tedious to watch. And that's not a criticism of the artistic merit of this film. It's like really amazing. But I just want to be clear to people it's difficult.
It is a comment. It's a comment on the artistic vision of the movie in that these things are heavy.
Right. And what we're doing is heavy. That. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's intense, man. And I mean, like, I've read a bunch of stuff just about Cassavetes in terms of him directing his actual wife, Gina Rowlands. And in a lot of these movies, or in a lot of the articles that I read, they talk about how whenever he does a movie, he exposes the makeup of himself, because Cassavetes is like a fucked up dude, right? Like, he died when he was 59 from alcoholism. And in all of the writing that I've read, it says that Cassavetes interjects himself into the movie via his wife, so that in Faces and also in Woman Under the Influence, the character of Gina Rowlands is Cassavetes putting himself in the movie. And it's like, right, it's really interesting just because that, you know, she is the sex worker in the movie, and that's how he sees himself in this whole thing. It's insane.
I mean, to be fair, at this point, she could have actually played either that role or the wife's role. Apparently in the casting, she was sort of on league to play both, but she thought because she was 4 months pregnant that she couldn't play the other role, the wife role. But then the actress that they cast, she was also pregnant. So actually both of those women both those women were pregnant when they were filming, which, by the way, for her role, that's a physical role. She falls down steps and stuff, and she was 3 months pregnant. And then there, you know, the big scene that they have when he comes home and he has that big scene with her in the beginning of the movie. That's actually a reshoot a year later. They reshot that part. And what's funny is she was already pregnant again, 3 months pregnant.
The funny thing is about that actress, he hired her while he was working on the script for Faces, but she was the secretary for Robert Altman at Screen Gems. While he was working on the script, he met her as Altman's secretary and just hired her for the movie.
And she's insane. Very good. She's very good at it.
She is so good in this movie. She is like, man, I think she's like truly transcendent as like this like forlorn and forgotten like wife. but then that just fills her own skin by the second act. It's just so interesting to watch. Like, the John Marley character of the dude, what's his name, Forrest, the main guy.
Yeah, Mr. Forrest. I forget, Nick, Mr. maybe? Forrest.
Yeah, Nick. Yeah. Like, oh, no, that's the name of Peter Falk in the other movie. What's his name in this one? I forget.
Oh, okay. I'll look it up. You can talk.
Shit. Richard Forrest. Anyway.
Okay.
Just that part of the movie to me is like, you know, we're used to seeing these weird, powerful men go through these horrific, like, you know, emotional breakdowns and then rebuild and by to their own, like, whatever skewed or imperfect standard, right? But in 1968, to do that focused on the female protagonist just seemed crazy when you're watching it now. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh my God, you're actually going to said earlier that this is like that movie that goes into places that people didn't look at that time. And seeing how much Cassavetes went into that, like all the way up until the suicide at the end, the suicide attempt at the end is so brutal and it's so bare. And it in the hands of a different actress, I think it wouldn't have worked as well. But
I agree. She's so also good in this movie. It's worth noting that one of the sets is John Cassavetes' home, which was next door to Frank Zappa. And so after they were done filming, a lot of the actors would stay up playing basketball and drinking in the driveway, but they didn't have to worry about being quiet because Frank Zappa's recording studio was in the garage next door, so it was always loud. So I love the – can you imagine you're in the house filming these intense scenes for Faces while John Lennon or David Bowie is next door getting high at Frank Zappa's house or something. Well, probably not getting high, I mean, actually, because Frank Zappa hated drugs. So just hanging out awkwardly with Frank Zappa while Frank Zappa doesn't offer you weed.
It's just imagining like a neighborhood where it's like, oh, yeah, Cassavetes lived here. Oh, and Zappa's right there, too. They live next door to
each other. It's crazy. It's just unbelievable. Like, yeah, Laurel Canyon real. It's just, how did that place exist? Like, what the fuck? Anyways. The point is, Faces is great. And it is, I think it fits this idea of smaller moments. The emotions are dire, but they're not huge. They're not, you know, no huge life threat. You know, I mean, it's suicide, but you know what I mean. Like, it's not the sort of story you would read on the front page. You know what I mean? It's people's lives. What I think is so interesting is that the same vibe goes into our next movie, even though the narrative of the movie could be seen because it deals with mental health as being far more extraordinary or exploitative or melodramatic, but it's not. It manages to tell the same kind of narrative with something far more alienating and focusing on mental health and the difficulties of a domestic partnership that has mental health issues going on. And that's A Woman Under the Influence from 1974.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's like it's not even a decade later, and just the generation of the style as it ends up here is so much more like different, you know?
Sure.
It's, man, I loved this movie.
And yeah, I mean, I really liked Faces. I don't want to downplay Faces. I think Faces was really important. But loving Faces is like loving something I already loved. It's like, oh, yeah, this is where all these things come from. This movie is along the same lines. It's not that it's not a John Cassavetes movie, but it's so different and it's fucking magical.
Yeah, it really is different. I mean, just from the opening shots, you know, just the look and like the refinement in the camera motion that still ends up being a character in the movie. And I get it. It's still that cinema verite style that he was a champion of and a progenitor of, but it's just that coupled with the refinement of what full funding can do, it's unbelievable. It's so good. It just looks beautiful. And also, let's be clear. The Criterion transfer of this movie is gorgeous. It looks amazing. You know what I mean? But, man, Gina Rowland's in this movie. God damn. So why don't you give us a brief overview about what this movie's about, Liam?
Yeah, so Gina Rowland's and Peter Falk are a couple. They have three kids. Peter Falk's character of Nick is like a rough and tumble kind of like a city
construction guy. Yeah,
I guess they do work with like water stuff or something. They never are quite clear, but he's a boss. Yeah. Like, he's important. He's, yes, he's salt of the earth. Yes, he's like a working man, blue-collar guy. But he's the boss man. He's important. He's the mm-hmm. kind of guy the city calls when something has gone wrong and they need his team to head out there. And he, mm-hmm. and he heads this team of rough-and-tumble guys, and we see them at his house. It's very telling that all of these men are either first/second generation Italian immigrants or black. Mm-hmm. Everyone on the crew is either an old Italian man or African American.
Or a young black dude. Yeah.
Yeah. And really showing, like, who were the poor people in LA at this time? Oh, yeah. These Italian immigrants, which, like, if you know the history of California, was very true. And then a generation later was black men. And they were that's what his crew is these men. And so basically, his wife is Gina Rollins, and she's. He describes her as eccentric, and we are never given any sort of diagnosis, which I think is helpful. But she's clearly has some sort of mental, behavioral, emotional health issues. They're never clarified, but clearly she's dealing with something. It feels like it's related to, like, deep insecurities and neuroses and stuff, but they don't spend a lot of time dealing with that per se. We
actually address the actual diagnosis.
What basically how the film starts is Peter Falk has promised her a date night, and you get the feeling that he's probably promised her many a date night over the years and not been able to follow through because of his job. And so this is the same thing this night. She sends the kids away and he doesn't show up, and he's so nervous to talk to her, thus showing he probably also has his own issues, which we see throughout the film, but this is sort of an early indication that he doesn't tell her. And so she gets really frustrated, and she goes out to a bar and she meets another guy and brings him home. And in the morning, she can't figure out what happened. And in fact, yeah. she even thinks for a little while that this new man is her husband.
Yeah. She calls him by her husband's name.
It's a whole thing. It's so awkward and painful. And then when he finally does come home, he brings home a whole crew of dudes and expects her to feed them. And she's just got to be like the happy homemaker, taking care of all these guys and making them spaghetti. She's going to make them spaghetti. Mm-hmm. And when things start to get a little off the rail later, he doesn't know how to react. And what you see is, I think a lot of her interactions were meant to see that she has this sense of, like, insecurity, where she doesn't know who she is, and she's looking for people to fill that up. But we also see the same sort of insecurity with his character. Nick is so worried about what people think of him. And throughout the movie, all of his decisions, everything he does is about responding to what people think of him and about his embarrassment. He clearly loves his wife, but he also is deeply embarrassed of when she acts not what people think is normal.
See, it's funny watching this movie with an eye that's been in a psych ward for 20 years. There's a lot of it that is very true to life.
Right.
And so in this movie, and again, I'm no doctor. I know that people don't know that. They listen. They're like, oh, that guy's obviously. I'm not a doctor. That said, when I'm watching this movie, it's very obvious to me that she's suffering from something of a schizoaffective disorder, which I don't know if you know what that means, but that's basically like one psychosis combined with like manic depressive, like a wild mood swing. So I would guess that she was schizoaffective. So basically a lot of times it's like manic depressiveness combined with schizophrenia. So that's like if you exhibit those, like both of those traits, then they categorize this as schizoaffective disorder. You know what I mean? And throughout the whole movie, she's responding to, she does a thing where she's like talking to herself and you could tell she's having a conversation, but no one's there. You know what I mean? So that's called responding to internal stimuli. And then there are other parts where she like takes on like this, like it's this almost psychotic need to please, which is very obvious in that first scene when she makes the spaghetti for the crew. And she's trying really hard to like please everybody at the table, which is like 12 dudes. And then also when she's with her children and she's trying really, really hard to like be like a child with them and run around and like do all these like, but then also the scenes like when she's waiting for her kids to come off of the bus, she's super explosive with people when they don't give her the time. She asks these two ladies walking by, hey, do you know what time it is? And they don't respond. And she like loses her mind. So all of that is extremely textbook of that specific disorder. And the funny thing about it is, in the again, in the research that I've done prior to watching these movies, you know, Cassavetes suffered from bipolar disorder. He was wildly bipolar, and the reason that he was so addicted to alcohol is because that was how he self-medicated to cope with it. And again, him interjecting himself into these narratives via his wife, it's very obvious that this is the art of a suffering person. And I think, to me, that's what makes this kind of a masterwork, in that, like, he really does tell all about himself without telling a thing.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
And it is unbelievable to watch, and but it is painful to watch.
I think part of why it works, though, too, though, is that Nick is also hurting. Nick is also not a full person. You know what I mean?
Well, like, yeah, but no, that's the whole thing about this type of diagnosis, right? Like, these people attract these people. And right, that right. is very much obvious by the third act of the movie when she comes home from the hospital. You know what I mean? Or even in the scene when he just impulsively takes the kids out of school and tells them to go have fun at the beach, like takes them to the yeah. beach.
It's clearly not like, warm have out. Fun. He's like, yeah. it's clearly not warm out. And he's just like, we're just going to have fun at the beach. And you're like, what is, and that has happened, by the way, because he may or may not have caused his friend to fall down a giant hill and break every bone in his body. Yeah. Now, it's not clear that he caused it, but he was just yelling at the guy, and he kind of like moves in a way where it looks like maybe he pushed him a little bit, or at least or had maybe him
like bumped into him. Some yeah. he's an older gentleman, and yeah. Incidentally, the guy who plays that is from McCunney Township in Pennsylvania.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's that guy's name? Charles Horvath.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, so we haven't really gotten too much into the plot, but basically the movie kind of breaks into two parts. And the first part is a variety of short scenes where we see her starting to lose control and
yeah, things sort of escalating into her psychosis.
Yeah. And then she goes away. And then we see a little bit of what life has been like while she's away. And then she comes back and things kind of erupt again. And really, there's not a whole lot of there's a lot of catharsis, but there's not a whole lot of resolution in the film, except for this one sort of detail, which is like when they finally have calmed down and they're going to bed and the phone is ringing, Peter Falk doesn't get the phone. And I think in a way, it's like the best they can do is like he's focused on her for once instead of worrying about the world around them. And I don't think that's meant to be like a happy ending. Like, I think these people are going to continue to have issues into their future. But there is some sort of moving forward. And I think it honestly made me a little emotional, that part where they're like, let's just go to bed. We're just going to bed. You know, like, I don't know. It's there's something beautiful about it. And, you know, I watched an interview with Peter Falk about it later. He definitely thinks of it as a love story. But it's certainly a love story between two people who are broken, who clearly don't have a lot of support. You know, whatever friends or family they have, they don't really have the support network they need to try to get healthy. That's not really an option in 1974, poor LA.
Yeah. It's, man, Peter Falk is so good in this movie.
He's so, and I get the feeling if we had watched like Husbands or some of the other movies he did with Cassavetes, I get the feeling he's good in all the Cassavetes movies he's done. But literally, I only know him from a few things. And so seeing, you know, not that, no disrespect to Columbo, but seeing Columbo do this was unexpected and it really blew me away.
Yeah. It's so good, man. It's just
he's so
him good. With the guys and him with the kids. Dude, just every single scene that he's in, he is so believable.
There's this part like, towards
that's
the,
how that dude is.
There's this part towards the end where she, Gina Rowlands, has hurt herself. And he's trying to put the kids to bed so he can, you know, deal with her in some way. And he keeps manhandling them up to the bedroom, and then they run away to go be with her. And it's one of the most heartbreaking. I mean, this whole movie, Josh, like, you know, I don't have a super rough childhood per se, but definitely, like, we had some tumultuous times. And the nerves that this was hitting, watching this, like, fucked me up, man. Like, I was just like imagining how those kids would feel and what their future would be like, and it was just like fucking tearing me apart, man. Like, yeah, no joke.
It's brutal, man. Yeah, it's brutal from the... I mean, dude, the scene when... So after they go to the beach, Peter Falk is in the back of the truck. Like, him and his coworker use this actual, like, work truck to take them to the beach and stuff. And then they're going back, and he's sitting in the back of the truck in the truck bed with his three children, drinking beer and having a cigarette. And he gives the beer to his sons and his daughter. Like, and they're, like, little kids. And, dude, that whole, like, just not knowing... It's brutal.
Him just saying, not too much now, not too much. Like, that's going to do anything. Like, it's so clear. Yeah. I mean, part of what's going what I think is interesting about both these movies is that John Cassavetes isn't trying to make political films, I don't think. He's trying to make personal films.
And he's trying to show himself in film.
And yet there's no – well, he said – one of his famous quotes is all of his movies are about love, that every movie he made is about love. I think that's obviously clear in Faces. I think it's also clear here, but the underlying politics have to be there, which is like 1974, there were a lot of parents who well, let's be more specific. There were a lot of dads who didn't actually know anything about child rearing. And that's probably true in the 50s and 60s. But what was happening by 1974 is a lot more people separating and being on their own. Like, can you imagine what it was like for those 3 months that she was away? I'm surprised the kids didn't die. Like, the fact that the kids survived those 3 months is a miracle. And not, like I said, his mental health issues. But he doesn't know how to parent. He doesn't know how to do anything but work and come home and be loud. He knows how to yell, and he knows how to do his job. And that's all that's required of him. And it's, like, not okay. He's not so really brutal. A functioning adult.
Yeah, it's true. Dude, intense. It's funny, too, because, like, one of the resonances that I had with this movie was, again, the mental health aspect of it all.
Right.
But the sequence when he's about to have her committed with Dr. Zapp, and they're talking to her, and she's just descending into her madness. She's just getting, like, just by the moment, you see her just getting sicker and sicker, you know what I mean? And the doctor's drawing up the needle, and Peter Falk is just looking at her while she's descending. And even though Peter Falk himself obviously suffers from illness and is obviously not in a right place, just the notion of helplessness that he conveys with his face while he's watching her dance around and show, like, put her fingers in the crucifix to the doctor and all these other things, like, that feeling of helplessness while you're watching, knowing that something's about to go down, which is that she's going to get committed, but they're going to have to hit her with a needle that slows her down. You know what I mean? Like, that was a very real reality of my day to day when I worked at the hospital. And it, like, just watching that happen, like, it instinctually caused these muscles in my psyche to flex, to know, like, okay, this is what you're supposed to do right now to handle this situation. And it was so real. It's so palpable. And I think it speaks to Gina Rowlands as an actress. Like, she's just so good in this role. And, like, that's the other thing, right? Like, we've talked about this on the show in the past about depictions of mental illness typically don't go the way actual mental illness happens in the real world. You get movies like The Peanut Butter Falcon, which is bullshit, or you get movies like New Year's Evil, which is also bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, you never know which, like, for me,
Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah, it's all horseshit. And it's funny because, like, again, as a former clinician who worked very closely with these populations, you always have to wonder, like, who built the monster, right? Like, do people act this way because of cinema, or does cinema react this way because of the people? And you never can tell. But in this movie, there's no question that the person who put this to paper, that Cassavetes knew exactly, without even the awareness that happens in this day and age, in the 70s or 80s, I mean, this is what, 78? Yeah.
74.
In the 70s, that the awareness of mental illness isn't anywhere close to what it is today, that it was so very spot on as to the experience of that, just shows how deeply hurt John Cassavetes was by his own illness. And how much of a companion that illness was in his process of making these movies. It's
It's truly an unbelievable film. I think it was. It's interesting because I think the film has had a mixed reception over the years from like a feminist lens. I think the film isn't meant to make Nick out to be the bad guy. I think he's supposed to seem broken like she is, and they're both broken. But when it first played, and it played to audiences of young women who were very much in the you know, women's liberation movement, they all booed our man Peter Falk when he came up on the title screen. They booed him because they hated him so much, and I think there is a politics here, and I do think the politics are related to issues of feminism because of the role that this, you know, in a real way, this character isn't given the space to even be mentally unwell or to deal with her issues because she has all these expectations of her as a wife and a mother, and expectations that her husband, who's, again, I don't think the villain of the movie, he's not prepared to deal with being a parent in any way, shape, or form. These kids are going to die if they have to stay with this man. Like, that's just the reality. And so, like, that is very much an issue of sexuality and gender politics. All that stuff is baked in. But the idea that, like, the issue here is just the fact that he is kind of a monster to her at times, I think that's meant to be a symptom of something and not like a, that's what this movie is about.
Yeah,
you know, and in the end, I think we're also supposed to believe that there is a love between them, even if maybe Cassavetes is a bit cynical about that love. Maybe that love isn't healthy. Maybe it's a codependent.
Codependence,
whatever. But it doesn't matter. It's there. And I think what he's trying to do is show the turmoil while still respecting that love is real. And I, you know, that's a more complicated take. But, watching it, that's what came across to me, and a deep politics about it. And I don't know that makes Cassavetes a feminist per se. But I do think, like, a reading of it now would, I think, highlight a lot of the complexities going on here that he, like, really, I think, in a very sensitive way, kind of highlights, you know?
Yeah, well, I also think, again, the weird gender shifting that puts him in the Gina Rowlands character makes this a really different read in terms of a feminist lens.
Right, that the whole reason he wanted to make a film about this kind of story is because he identifies with that character. He certainly doesn't identify with Nick. Again, I don't think that makes Nick the villain. I think that's a not a great reading of the film. But I do think Nick is the character he identifies with the least in the movie.
Yeah. I think it's really funny, too, that both his mom and Gina Rowlands' mom is in the movie, too, as their actual mothers.
Yeah.
And I think her daughter's in this movie, too, isn't it? Isn't her daughter one of the ladies at the party?
I think so. And also Seymour Cassell's son is one of the kids in the movie.
I think one of her kids plays one of the small kids as well. I don't really know. I it's one of those things. There's so much about this movie floating around to like that just like preens into the inner workings of both Cassavetes and Gina Rowlands and just the whole movie in general. But there's so much stuff in this movie that is so like, I mean, there's so much to read through. You know what I mean? Because I know, contrary to form, I did do a little research prior to this episode. And there's just so much about like how many people are in this movie and their connections to Cassavetes and his cadre of friends and co-conspirators. You know what I mean? Like, it's really interesting.
It's kind of cool, so man. One of the kids in it is Matthew Labiorto. I have no idea how to say that for real. But he's known mostly for Little House on the Prairie. He's one of the kids on Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. And then the other kid is Matthew
Cassell.
Yeah. And then Maria Cristina Grisante. I don't know if she went on to do anything else. No, it looks like this is her only role.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. But yeah, what a movie, huh?
Yeah.
It's so good. This movie is painful to watch, but it is such a good movie. It's just unbelievable. I loved it.
I'm a big fan. There was a couple like smaller roles in it. One of the ones that stood out to me, and I couldn't figure out why, was Mario Gallo. He plays Harold Jansen, which, by the way, he doesn't look like a Harold Jansen at all. He looks like a Mario Gallo. He had roles in Raging Bull, King Kong 1980, whatever it is, and Revenge of the Ninja. And it's just funny to like watch this and be like, why do I know that guy?
Yeah, he always plays like a seedy dude. He plays like like one of those like shifty-eyed characters, you know what I'm saying?
Right. But when he's like, I don't know if I should leave the kids here with you, I'm kind of like, he might be right. I think he's right.
Yeah. Dude, that scene is so brutal too. And she like, yeah. And then the kids are naked all of a sudden, just running all through the house with like, just like pirates. And then, oh my goodness. And Gina Rowlands is like trying to like, I just want to make again the people pleaser aspect of that illness. Like, I just wanted to make it good, you know. And then like, Peter Falk comes home and he hits her. Oh my god, it's him and his mom come home.
It's horrifying.
It is brutal, man. So brutal.
Again, you know, you see these moments of Peter Falk's character where you're like, okay, I kind of get where this guy's coming from. But there's also these moments of anger and violence that you're like, what is this dude's? He's a monster. And the fact that Falk is able to so convincingly be this guy who like is both, is these things, you know, and
like really seamlessly occupies both of these theories.
Well, and you straight up know. In a different time, if this was a couple today, he would have just as strong a diagnosis and as many, you know, things that he had to go through as she does. You know, she might be, her symptoms might seem more extreme, but there's no way this guy doesn't have some diagnosis he's working through. He's got something he's working through and needs help with, you know? And seeing them interact is like seeing these two tornadoes slam into each other. It's a lot. And yet all done in a way that doesn't feel like scene chewing over the top. Yeah.
It's so good. And that's the thing, right? It's actually like the small ball of baseball. Like, you're just moving the runners from base to base. Like, this whole movie, it is told in minutia. It is told in facial, like, expressions and, like, in these, like, micro emotions put forth between, like, just masterful actors. I think about the scene where Gina Rowlands she comes back from the hospital and her dad, played by Fred Draper, who also is in Faces, is like, he gets in an argument with Peter Falk when he's like, don't tell me to sit down and all this other stuff. And like, it's all comes from this mutual yet completely different affection towards Gina Rowlands' character, who they're handling with each of their individual definitions of kid gloves. And it's so different, but it's so like
the scene with her, the scene, that part where she, and the scene with her children is just, it's like a knife in my eye. It's so hard, but
it's so hard. It gave me a stomach ache.
Yeah.
Like watching it, I just had that feeling in my stomach, like, oh, I think I have to shit like that. Ugh.
Well, so brutal. I, you know, let's just give a little bit here of you know, if this sort of thing, if what we've been describing now sounds like something you want, we cannot recommend these movies enough. If this sort of thing sounds like utter torture for you, then like, stay away. This is not for you. You know what I mean? I don't think it's. I'm not one of these people that's like, for the sake of your film education, you must suffer through both of these movies, even if you know that this particular kind of film isn't for you. I don't think that's fair. I don't think people need to do anything. But I do think if you already like these sort of emotionally raw, you know, whatever cinema verite means, but like, you know, real world, whatever, then this is it. This is ground zero, and you need to start here. You know, it's like, you know, if you like Boston Strangler, you really should listen to Jerry's Kids, or, you know what I mean? Like, there's a sense in which this is ground zero for something you already like, then you should definitely go back to it. But it's also an example of the films we love not loving us back. Like, these are both exacting films. Neither one of these movies could you put on at a party and be like, it's cool, guys. It's cool.
Just let this roll.
We'll be good. you would never put these in a secret screening. I think that would be, you know, this is never going to play on someone's secret screening, because it would be like, oh, really? This is what we're going to do right now? And again, none of that is to dissuade you. They're both amazing films, but they are asking a lot of you, and you have to be the kind of person who wants to do that. For me, I thought they were both like perfect.
Yeah. But again, if this is a thing that is just too close to home, there is no valor in suffering through a movie that you know is going to hurt you. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to watch Serbian film. for the sake of your like. Oh, but there's also
no.
Experience.
There's hopefully no one is suggesting that you have to watch that movie because that movie is fucking trash. That movie
sucks. But or like 120 Days of Scylla. Like you don't need to watch that if that's gonna fuck you up. There's no need.
Sallow, and I don't know. I guess some people do that. I you know what? We should cover that movie sometime because I think that movie.
I still haven't seen it. I think it's watched overrated. It, and I'm not going to see it. I'm not going to watch that. I'm not watching Caligula. I'm not watching any of those fucking fucked up movies from back then.
Oh, see, no, I would do Caligula in a second. Caligula is just a very powerful and gory drama that then they cut in fucking because they had to make. No, like for real, it was literally like we're going to make this this very emotional sex drama, and then they're like, there's not enough sex in this sex drama, so they just keep cutting to people boning, and it's really funny because I was watching, they covered it in that movie in that flesh. What was that movie called? Skin? I don't know what it's called. But the actor who's in Caligula, he was saying how. You know, there was nudity on set, but a lot of the actual fucking, that didn't happen. They filmed that later and cut it in. So there's all these moments where he's doing these dramatic things, and then they cut from what he's doing, which is supposed to be for something else, to, like, someone fucking. So it looks like he's responding to them fucking. But, like, in reality, he didn't see any of that. You know, he didn't even know anything about that. Like, he knew it was going to be a sexy movie because of who was making the movie. But the extent to which that movie is just straight up boning is definitely not anything that the main actors knew anything about. Malcolm McDowell. He's interviewed in that Skin movie, and he talks about how he had no idea that that's what was going on.
Wow, that's really funny. I didn't watch it, but big up to Justin LaLiberty, contributor in CinePunks.
Sure, you know, yeah.
Dude who had a hand in making that movie. But anyway, not important.
Did he? Did he have? I don't think he did.
Or he had a hand in like its distro or something like that, didn't he?
I don't think so. I think he only I think he only recommended it because that gentleman who recently passed away, Mike McPadden. Yeah, he was in it. He's one of the talking heads in it and actually does a really good job because his big expertise is 80s sex comedies. That's like a thing he is into. And so they cover that time. He knows a lot. He's super knowledgeable about all those kind of movies. Or I guess I should say was because he tragically passed away very recently. So.
Rest in peace.
Yeah.
And on that note,
yeah, I know. So what a great way to end an episode. If you want to watch depressing
movies by John Cassavetes, it's actually the perfect note to end a Cassavetes episode on because these movies are bummers, y'all. These movies are not fun. they're good, but they're not fun.
I don't know if that's true of all of his movies. As we said, these are the first two that we've seen, but I think we're in to watch more. I just don't know if they're all going to be like this or not.
Yeah, dude. And it's funny, too, because, again, this is in stark contrast to the actual movies he was acting in order to make these movies, which I think is a very interesting take for an artist, right? To be like, well, I'm going to sell out here so that I can buy in here.
Yeah. Well, we might as well wrap up then and say, hey, check out these movies. Thank you for listening to the show. If you haven't listened yet, go back and listen to our LDP interview because we were very happy with it. Check out CinePunks.com to hear further amazing podcasts, whether that's Horror Business or Evil Eye or Tomb of Ideas, Black Sun Dispatches, Fat Girl Hacks, Weird Obscure and Possibly Unsafe. There's just a whole family of great, great podcasts that we think that you would enjoy.
Yeah. And we enjoyed too.
Okay. So that's it. I guess that's it.
Episode 126, done and done. Thank you so much for listening. Always remember to rate, review, subscribe, and we will talk to you soon. We love you. Smoke bomb.
Okay, bye.
Do you like spooky movies?
Hair-raising tales.
Insightful criticism.
Judgmental hot takes. Then you're going to love Horror Business, the horror podcast on the CinePunks Podcast Network dedicated to all things weird and spooky.
My name is Leo Donald.
And I'm Justin Lohr. And every episode, we're going to tear apart your favorite and not-so-favorite horror movies to get to the bottom of what makes these movies great, or maybe not great.
Whether it's The Beyond, Prince of Darkness, or Inseminoid, we dive in on a double feature every episode, and then we talk about it. Some of our insights are great, and sometimes we just complain.
So if we have to suffer through it, so do you.
Horror Business, available anywhere you find fine podcast products.